Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 18, Crossovers!
That's not what we're talking about.
No, I'm looking at our notes. It says crossover.
Yeah, crossover. We're not talking about crossovers.
But I did all this research. I read Infinity Gauntlet, Infinity War, Infinity Crusade, Infinity Crisis, Infinity Quest, Infinity Now, Infinity's End.
Well, I'm sorry, but we're not talking about crossovers. We're actually doing a crossover.
Oh, that explains why we're on Skype with a guest. Now it all makes sense.
Let's try that again.
Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily.
I am Michael Bailey.
And you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 18, Longbox Showcase, Truth, Justice, and the American West.
And as you may have noticed, we've got a guest! Welcome, Michael Bailey, to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. I'm a big fan of the show. Oh. And it's really nice that now I can listen to you guys talking and actually respond and you can hear me instead of me being at work talking to myself and having everyone kind of look at me funny while we're, you know, before we open. So,
yeah, I mean, we're not here to help your mental health. Well, we're here to help the appearance of mental health.
It's really the best we can do.
So, Mike, tell us why we're here, what we're doing, and how this actually is a crossover.
Well, this is a crossover because we're going to be doing one part of the book we're going to be covering here, and then we're going to go over to Views from the Long Box and do another chapter, and then hop back into the car and drive back to Ohio and do the third chapter of a series that... This is going to sound like an insult, but it's not. It's a series no one asked for, but I'm so glad we got. It is called The Kents, and this was published over the course of a year from 1997 to 1998. It was written by John Ostrander. The first two four-issue arcs were drawn by Tim Truman and Michael Baer, and the third one was done by John Ostrander's longtime Spectre collaborator, Tom Mandrake. And what this story does is it talks about not only the history of Kansas from shortly before the Civil War to right after the Civil War, but also the history of the Kent family. And I remember when this series was announced that I was really excited, and I remember really liking it, and I remember enjoying every issue as it came out. It, you know, when we were starting to talk about maybe covering it, I realized I remembered nothing about it, which is kind of odd for me. But you also have to understand, when this series came out, I was at the heaviest of my collecting everything, just about everything in the DC universe. So I wasn't just reading the Superman titles. I was reading the Batman titles. I was reading Flash, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, JLA, you know, just about everything else. So this went into the blender with a lot of other stuff, but I'm so glad that you guys were wanting to talk about this because it let me dig the issues out, read them again from almost 15 or so years later, and this is a gorgeous series.
It really is.
Start to beginning, really? Because I can talk. from beginning to end, it is just... The artwork is amazing, the writing is rich, and it feels like what it's supposed to be, which is a Western at a time when the Western was kind of dead, especially in terms of comic books.
Yeah, this was part of the period where Jonah Hex was in his wilderness period, so to speak, in terms of about 15 years really out of a main comic, and I think a lot of other DC Westerns at least had certainly been on decline, so... This wasn't it, and this is an interesting take because it's as much as we'll get into it, historical fiction set in that period. And
yeah, it's really funny because if I would have had more time, I would have sat there and read it, you know, in front of my computer with Wikipedia, you know, at the ready to kind of look these things up. But
every time they drop a name.
But Ostrander, I think, does a pretty good job of making the history conversational enough that you don't get lost in it. Like when you have like three pages of what is essentially exposition, but it's really a history seminar. The overview, the 1,000-foot view of this series is that as much as it is steeped in real life history with real life historical figures interacting with the fictional characters that Ostrander creates, I don't think it ever got lost in that. Right. I was never bored throughout the entire thing because the story itself, which is really what I was focused on, had me so riveted that I was just like, okay, yeah, that's really great. We fought the Civil War. What's going on with Jeb Kent?
Oh, Jeb Kent.
Now, our origin story with this series starts with Emily, so...
Yes, I am so glad that this worked out. You having this history with the series and buying it as it came out and enjoying it and all of that, because I just picked it up on a whim. It was at one of our 25-cent comic sales that I saw a Western book. And I was like, oh, that looks interesting. Pulled it out, and it's The Kents. And it had the Superman S on it. And I was like, okay, I am intrigued. You have done your job cover. I have no idea what this thing is, but I'm putting it in my bag, and I'm taking it home, and I'm reading it.
And that was issue one, right?
Yes. Yeah, started with issue one, and it just was like, oh, well, you know, I'll just check it out. And if I don't like it, it was 25 cents, whatever. Took it home, read it, and immediately said, okay, Dad, for Christmas, I want the rest of it. And so it was off to eBay and back to the 25-cent sale.
I was actually able to get about 8 of them, I think, in the 25-cent bins. And then a couple of them for a couple bucks. And then one of them cost like $3.50. I'm still not sure why, but...
That is Murphy's Law of buying cheap comics. It really is. You will find 16 issues of an 18-issue series for 25 cents. And that last issue will cost you $10.
That sounds familiar.
You know, not only is this a good value, quote unquote, it took $10 for the whole series, but it was so incredibly fun that this is the sort of series that I really enjoy, where it's just a fun adventure and it doesn't have to get super dark and gritty and depressing, but it'll have genuine moments of character and pathos and moments of pretty legit horror, because spoilers, the Civil War happens. It is horrific. And it is, in my opinion, as a student of history and sociology and thus really well represented in that, it is horrifying. But at no point does this get depressing or unpleasant to read. It's always... It's that feeling you were talking about like, oh yeah, all of this stuff is happening historically. What's going on with Nate? What's going on with Jeb? What's going on with all of these other characters that I'm really invested in?
And as we're recording this, news just has broken within a day or two that our favorite New 52 series, All-Star Western, has been canceled. This is our chance to dive back in, understand, experience what a good Western comic can be.
It's sad that that series is going, but man, Hex stuck around, you know, beyond just the New 52 series. You know, he had over 50 issues of a series before that. So
right, yeah, leading into it, so.
I'm glad it was around, but frankly, it was one of those things that I was always kind of surprised was sticking around as long as it did. Not because it was bad, but just because I'm friends with Scott Gardner, so I know people who love Jonah Hex.
Yeah.
Like he was a brother, but... It's kind of weird in this current environment and the readership that is buying comics right now. I'm just shocked that Western survived. And I'm shocked that they found artists that could draw horses, because apparently that was a problem in the early stages of that series. They couldn't find contemporary artists back in like 2005, 2006 that could draw a horse.
That's a problem if you're on a Western comic.
Yeah, I've heard that story before. Well, let's take a little quick break here, and we will come back and start talking about the miniseries, The Kents.
My name is Michael Bailey, and I am a terrible geek. I don't watch Doctor Who, I don't care for anime, I've never seen any of the Harry Potter films, much less read the books. I like Star Wars and Star Trek okay, but I've never really ventured far into the extended universes of either property. Hell, I have never even watched a single episode of The Walking Dead. So what do I like?
Comic books.
I have been reading and collecting comic books since 1987, and I have been a fan of superheroes for as long as I can remember. Some would consider this a hobby, but I prefer to look at it as what it truly is, a crippling addiction that I may never recover from. To deal with this borderline personality disorder, I started a podcast in 2007 called Views from Long Lost. Every 2 weeks, or so, depending on real life, I pick a particular series, or issue, or character, or whatever to talk about, and then I... Well, I talk about them, because that's kind of the point of a podcast. Sometimes I'm alone. Sometimes I have a guest, like my semi-regular co-host, the Irredeemable Shag, or my other semi-regular co-host, Thomas DJ, or with another friend from the podcasting world. The show is located at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com, and from there you can find the iTunes link, the email address, as well as the backlog of episodes.
Views from the Long Box.
A podcast about comics, or a desperate cry for help? You decide. Every other Tuesday, or so, depending on real life, at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com.
And we're back.
The first issue opens with the framing sequence of Clark Kent's adopted father, Jonathan, writing to his adopted son, Superman. He's discovered letters and memoirs on the family farm back in Smallville in a buried strongbox, way too heavy for a man of his age and history of heart maladies to be hauling around. The documents chronicle the Kent family history in the 19th century, revealing that they were noted abolitionists who assisted the leadership of the Underground Railroad, including Harriet Tubman. In 1853, family patriarch Silas Kent moves with his two oldest boys, Nathaniel, Nate, and Jebediah, Jeb, to Kansas, planning to bring the rest of his sizable family out later. This is part of a concerted effort to move anti-slavery families into the territories before they vote on whether to allow or ban slavery in the territory. Unfortunately for the Kents and their compatriots, pro-slavery families from around the nation have had the same idea. Silas Kent acquires a printing press and has started a pro-abolitionist newspaper. Of course, he then ran into tons of trouble from the pro-slavery crowd, especially one Luther Reed, who threatened Silas, accusing him of libel. Silas is able to find potential allies in the region, including a legister named John Henry Lane, very distant relative of a certain award-winning journalist for a great metropolitan newspaper. Silas is gunned down one night, shot in the back, and Nathaniel and Jeb set out to track down the border ruffian that did the deed. But it seems that old Luther Reed has the local sheriff firmly on his side. Things don't look terribly good in Kansas for the Kents.
Mike, thoughts on issue one?
I really liked Silas Kent as a
Me
character.
Too!
The weird thing about reading this series is, given, you know, things that are going on in the country right now, and I'm not going to turn this into a political discussion or a, you know, discussion on the state of America, but it's kind of interesting that a lot of the things that are being discussed in this, you know, the abolition of slavery and all that, and if, you know, we're reading about a country that is on the precipice of a great change. And we are kind of in the similar position now. It's like the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's just, you know, it's, if it isn't slavery, it's women voting. If it's not women voting, it's equal rights for all. You know, if it's not equal rights for all, it's you can marry whoever you want to. And every time one of those issues comes up in any kind of meaningful way where something is really about to change, there seems to be this constant arguing amongst the citizenry, even though this is set in the mid-1800s, I still related to everything that was going on in it, even though I've never had to fight against slavery, thankfully. It was really the Kent boys, and I'm talking not only about Silas and Jeb and Nate, but Jonathan and Clark, too, because at this point, we're dealing with a Clark Kent that for the first 18 years of his life believed he was the son of Jonathan and Martha. He wasn't told he was from, you know, the rocket didn't come up until his senior year of high school. Okay. So you have a man that believes, that grew up believing he was part of this family, and from what Jonathan says in his letters and such, Clark always had an interest in history and an interest in the history of the Kents. So for Clark to be reading all of this must be exciting on so many levels for him. You know, not just as a reporter who is seeking the truth, but as a man who thinks of himself first and foremost as a human and as a Kryptonian second. So you really couldn't do this with a Superman that knew he was from Krypton in the, you know, from the beginning, because then you don't have a character that is as emotionally invested. So as I was reading this, and every once in a while they show Clark, you get the sense of excitement that he's just fascinated with this. And the one thing about this series that was good and but kind of bothered, and this is going to sound weird, that kind of bothered me on the same level, is that when you do historical fiction like this and you deal with the issue of slavery, there is always more of a black and white dealings with the people that were for slavery and the people that were against slavery. And that feeling was here. The one thing I would have liked to have seen, and this is going to sound weird, but I would have liked to have seen the people that weren't necessarily for slavery, but it's all they ever knew, so they were kind of curious about why anyone would want to change that. And I'm not saying they're right, I'm just saying that would have been an interesting story element.
Right.
But having said that, you know, right away, you know, Silas Kent, his boys, Jeb, not as much, but are not going to put up with any kind of shenanigans. And seeing them leave their home and try to make their fortune west in an untamed land, and running afoul of some pretty horrendous examples of humanity. You know, when Silas died, it was upsetting.
Oh, yeah.
Right there, you start the clock of when that when Luther Reed is going to die. Because it's a Western, so he's going to die.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And given Silas's prominence on the cover of issue one, and in the first issue itself up to that point, I was very surprised by his death. I assumed he would be at least a major character, you know, the family patriarch image, if not the major character, so becomes the son's book instead, and that took me by surprise.
Right.
I made my notes as I read each issue, so and some of my notes are become superseded as further issues occur, but definitely the idea that this is really going to be the sort of classic Civil War brother versus brother story kind of took me by surprise, or at least the manner of Silas's death, the swiftness of it took me by surprise.
Yeah, and I expected that to happen, but I was expecting it to happen around 3 or 4, right about when the Civil War would be coming, that at that point, Silas would die and the family would splinter, and then you'd have one brother on each side. And then it would sort of turn into the more typical Civil War family split story. Mm-hmm. But it was an unexpected development, but it, I think, absolutely works for the story, that it helps really give Nate this weird sort of chip on his shoulder about trying to be the patriarch then and trying to take his father's place. Which I think actually helps the growing relationship and resentment between the brothers make a lot of sense. That it's not just Jeb is young and foolish and dumb and doesn't understand the moral issues that his father and his brother are fighting for. It's that he resents his older brother. And I'm like, again, that's one of those genuine character motivations that I thought really rang true in this.
Two quick artistic notes. One, hats off to the letterer of this series.
Yes,
for making the letters in the journals look so distinctive. Hats off.
Yet always readable, always legible.
Hats off to John Ostrander for writing, "Dear Sheriff Jones, I got me a complaint to make against two Yankee boys who has threatened me, and I ain't done nothing, and I would be obliged if you would arrest them as my life is in considerable dangers."
Yep.
And that was educated back then. So that's the funny part. Also, Nathaniel Kent looks a little like Clark. I think that's very much on purpose.
We will say a little.
And he has long hair, and I'm just going to say it right now, not a mullet. So
I was wondering how long it would take until the not a mullet would show up.
Oh, come on. It's me.
I called 26 minutes. I think we came in just under that. So
see,
I think you won.
I was hoping that I would be able to maybe get in one mullet joke before you made the not a mullet. And,
Mike just looked this up on his Zune, and it's not a mullet.
Not a mullet.
Zune. It was a good piece of equipment. I dropped that thing 1,000 times. Mike Zune, 2006 to 2008. 2012.
Mike sadly walking away from the electronic shop.
But, no, but just outside of, you know, really getting into the characters, my last note is a note in hindsight. Jim Lane is introduced into the story so innocuously.
Yep.
And he ends up becoming such a huge part. And I love that. I love that you really didn't think much of him at first. So when you go back and read it after, you know, when you're looking through it, you know, because we're doing notes and we're doing critical analysis and all that, you would have thought Luther Reed would be the big bad guy, but he doesn't even really turn into the big bad guy. So it's just great that Ostrander is able to create this cast of characters and pit good against evil, dark against light, whatever. But in the middle of it, even the good guys are kind of tarnished, and even the bad guys, you know, have a point sometimes. So it's really,
right.
This is why I love this series so much, because it's so compelling, and it makes it feel like more than what I was talking about before, where, you know, if you were for slavery, you were automatically the most vile human being and like to beat people and all that. And if you were against it, you would have never done anything bad in your life. And we see that that is very not the case in this story.
And I agree that it could have definitely been furthered. I suppose that there could have been a wider range of people with a wider range of opinions on slavery and relations to slavery and the idea of slavery. But I think that it does do at least an adequate job of giving you good people who are doing bad things, bad people who are still sympathetic, good people who are fighting for what we would generally consider to be wrong, very wrong, but that doesn't make them monsters automatically. And it does a good job of showing that evolution of some people becoming monsters or avoiding becoming monsters.
I thought there were moments in the series, I'm sure we'll talk about, where there is some nuance. There's a little bit of that. My note as of reading it was something to the effect of, obviously they're going to be Kents here. I'm okay that there's a Lane here as well. And I know there has to be someone named Luther who's going to be an adversary. But I did say, if any Rosses show up, I'm really going to be annoyed. Because that would be pushing it. I mean, it did sort of remind me, we mentioned All-Star Western, reminded me of the All-Star Western version of 1880s Gotham, which seemed to be made up completely of families that are important in the 2000s in Gotham City.
Mm-hmm. Waynes and the Arkhams.
Waynes and Arkhams and Cobblepots, etc.
I think there's even a Kyle or something, you know, and I was like, really?
There was almost one too many there, and I think at this point I'm thinking one more is going to be pushing it, Ostrander.
And speaking of which, is you mentioned, Michael, with having a Luther name dropped pretty early and a Lane, and Luther not becoming the villain. There was, my copy does not have page numbers, so I'm going to say roughly page 15-ish. There's one of the few sequences of modern day dialogue where Lois and Clark are sitting and talking about the letters that they've just gotten from Jonathan. And Clark asks about, you know, was there any relation to this Lane guy? And when Lois describes Lane, she describes him as being a lot like Lex Luthor. I appreciated that. I was like, oh, see, so you're going to name drop them, but still develop them into their own characters. And the Lane is actually going to take on a large amount of the Luthor's role.
Artistic note on that, flash forward with Clark, that doesn't look like Truman's artwork. That looks more like Stuart Immonen's take on Clark Kent. The present stuff looked very different from the stuff from the past, which I appreciated.
Right.
But Clark does not look like how I would imagine Tim Truman drawing Clark Kent.
Hmm.
And I actually get the feeling that they probably did that because they drew Nate to look so much like Clark that if you'd drawn Clark looking like Clark, there might have been some moments of whiplash of like, wait, what? Hang on. What year are we in again?
Yeah. I did note it was in the back matter that Ostrander put in the first couple of issues that the Lane character, is it Jim Lane?
Jim Lane, yeah.
Jim Lane is actually a historical figure. So I imagine Ostrander doing his research and saying, ooh, I found somebody named Lane. You know, I'm
excellent.
Perfect. Score. All right. Issue 2. Luther Reed is angry that the Kent brothers have accused him of murdering their father. He and Sheriff Sam Jones ride out to the Kent homestead and arrest Jeb. They drag him down to Blanton's Crossing, where they plan to hang him for threatening Luther's life in the previous issue. Jeb's brother Nate shows up with a rifle and convinces them to let Jeb go. Nate knows that the feud between the Kents and Luther's men will only get worse. As winter wears on, Luther's crew becomes more aggressive. There's talk that they may even lay siege to Lawrence to force out the abolitionists. Charles Robinson meets with Nate and Jeb, and they stand ready to defend their home should a move be made. To make matters even more tense, the outspoken abolitionist John Brown rolls into town, preaching his message of the coming day of judgment. He's accompanied by a group of Native Americans who join the defenders to protect the town. Nate suggests making a plea to Governor Shannon for federal troops, and Robinson sends two volunteers to accompany Nate to the governor's office. Jeb takes it upon himself to accompany the group, and the boy's recklessness gets one of the two volunteers killed. Fed up with his brother's thrill-seeking, Nate cold-cocks him. Fortunately, the messengers reach the governor's office, and he sends troops to intervene in Lawrence. Jeb and Nate receive a letter in the spring telling them that their mother Abigail has passed away. Nate leaves Jeb in charge of the print shop and collects his mother's remains from Boston, brings them back to Lawrence so they can be buried next to her husband. On the trip back home, Nate meets Wild Bill Hickok, who helps Nate sneak past a group of Missourians trying to block the border. A few days later, Nate Kent is asked to serve as a delegate of the Free State group for their journey to Washington. Nate brings his case before President Franklin Pierce, but Pierce buckles under political pressure and cannot ratify a document that would make Kansas a free state. Nate, Charles Robinson, and John Henry Lane argue their case before a senator, and the senator agrees to take on the argument for them on the floor. Moments later, Nate receives a letter from Jeb. Luther Reed's gang has incited a riot in Lawrence, and Jeb has been fighting to defend the town. Nate mounts his horse and rides back to Kansas, saying, "If I'm not in time to save them, by God, I will avenge them." Emily, your thoughts on issue 2?
I enjoyed it. There was a lot of politics in this one.
This was the slowest, I think, of the 12 issues. This was the one where I started to wonder, uh-oh, what have I gotten into? But I enjoy the political machinations, but I thought the story slowed down a little bit too much here in the second issue for my taste.
I thought Wild Bill Hickok looked like Nicolas Cage throughout the entire issue. It's kind of strange. No, I'll agree that in terms of reading it, this one did take a little longer because the particulars of the various issues that are bringing up, because it's not just about slavery, it's about what kind of state Kansas is going to become, it's about which political power is going to take over. But to me, the heart of this issue is the growing tension between Jeb and Nate.
Absolutely.
And the fact
right.
that their relationship, which wasn't super strong to begin with, really is starting to deteriorate. And the death of their mother really didn't help that. Nate wants to keep calm. Jeb wants to be Jeb. And it's just kind of interesting to see the two of them fall out over the course of the first four issues. And that's why another reason why I think this series is paced so well is that it's not like in this issue they're enemies and they're never going to speak to each other again.
Right.
It's like family. It's a little more complicated
yeah.
than that. What this issue really drove home is how wild this area of the country was at this time. I cannot imagine living in a town or living in an area where I can't call 911 if a bunch of people are surrounding my house and wanting to shoot me, and not being overly worried that 911 isn't siding with the people that are wanting to kill me. You know, this is the storyline is bleeding Kansas, and the reason that is that a lot of people died, you know, to get us out west. The further west we went, the more hardship it was, and those were some, you know, I hate to get on a soapbox, but those had to be some really hardy people. People of, you know, of conviction, of wanting pro-slavery or anti-slavery. If you were out there, you were a pretty tough human being in
mm-hmm.
general. And, you know, there were probably moments of comfort, but then, you know, everyone carried a gun for a reason.
Yeah.
So you know, is there was no discussion on gun control.
No. The guns were the control. Exactly. Argument over.
And seeing that also that politics really hasn't changed in the last 100 or so years also kind of does my heart good that, you know, we're really never going to get this right.
Yeah.
So we might as well just make do with what we have, because from the beginning to right now, you know, we may look at the founding fathers and we may look at the politicians of the past with some admiration or with scorn or whatever, as, you know, more and more history comes to light. The fact of the matter is the way these people are arguing about this is the way senators and congressmen are arguing in the United States and in Europe and in the UK right now. It's that feeling of, even though I'm reading something from set in the past, I can still relate to what's going on in it.
Political quote-unquote discussion can get heated here in the 21st century, whether that's on Facebook or across the dinner table. But sort of like you were saying, I can't envision the House being surrounded if I want to, you know, vote this November.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
and who you're going to vote for.
Exactly. That's going to be a take my life in my hand decision. Did want to mention this idea of people moving into the territories to get the people from your side into there before
there was really a fixed border.
Right. And before the ballot
was
taken, the vote was taken as to what kind of state you would be. Reminded me, there was a movement maybe 20 years ago, or at least talk of a movement 20 years ago, among members of the Libertarian Party to get all of the Libertarians on the East Coast to move to Delaware, all the ones in the West Coast to move to Wyoming. Because those are the states with small populations. Theory being that if you had enough...
You can then get control and a seat.
You could have a libertarian state and show what that would be. So this notion of, well, let's flood Kansas with pro-slavery or anti-slavery folks to affect the elections is not that crazy a notion. And similar ones have at least been kicked around in more modern times.
Like you said, this isn't crazy talk. This isn't, I can't relate to that, because people will always find a way to push their agenda.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that the Libertarians wanted to do that. I really wonder how Delaware would have ended up if that had happened, in all honesty. But still, anyways, I can see this happening today just in a different way. Come on, let's face it, gerrymandering.
I wasn't going to say it, but yes, this.
We do get the equivalent of that. I did want to mention a couple other things. Obviously, we mentioned the historical figures. There was in the first issue, a passing reference to Harriet Tubman, and did mention that Jim Lane was a real historical figure. But here we get Wild Bill Hickok, who really is a historical superstar.
Yeah.
And actually will play a continuing role throughout the whole series.
Which, again, I did not see Bill Hickok becoming, you know, the equivalent of Fifth Build on the poster, that he would become not just a recurring character, but a fairly major character for the rest of the series.
Quick aside, what did you guys make of the ads in these books? Because to me, it was a time capsule, but I'm really wondering what it's like to see.
I will tell you, this is an era I was totally out of comics. I was getting out of comics all throughout the early to mid-90s. We just had a baby and everything, and so
I kind of crushed your comics budget. Sorry about that.
And by 97, 98, I do not believe I was getting any new books at all. These were, in some cases, first times that I'd been seeing some of these, and they certainly are different from the ones I'm reading on Quarterbin Podcast from, you know, the early to mid-80s. This is all video games and candy and
Mellow Yellow, which I appreciated. I just looked at them and went, 1990s. It brings me back to my young childhood.
The one I wanted to mention is the Watch This Space, which was a big part of DC's House ads at this point. Yeah. And the fact that they're pimping the AOL chat room discussions.
Oh, I just saw that.
I did
That's
see
adorable.
The end of every issue had the DC Comics Online Starter Kit.
about the time that this series was really wrapping up is when I got online for the first time, and I had AOL. So going to the DC site was really awesome, and you could actually, they had a list, and you would never see this today, they had a list of email addresses for creators. So you could write Dan Jurgens or John Byrne or Wade or whatever. And it was okay because while it could get a little crazy, it wasn't like it is now you just never would want to do that. Because of the of getting online is when I actually became something of a letter hack for a short period of time, which was weird, and it's why I missed the letters pages, but that's entirely beside the point. But no, just seeing, I mean, can you imagine today getting Grant Morrison to do a web chat with his editors, much less, you know, it's really hard for me to not look at that and go, ah, I remember this era. I remember it so well.
I would pay good money for a Reddit AMA and Ask Me Anything with Grant Morrison. I would just be like, what is going on in there? Like, I just want to know. Before we move on, I do want to talk a little bit more about Jeb and Nate's relationship. And again, another one of those rare dialogue bits in the modern day with Lois and Clark, where they talk about Wild Bill Hickok. And they talk about some experts and historians thinking that in the past he would have been diagnosed with attention deficit syndrome or attention deficit disorder, whatever. That idea of a sort of mental health revisionism and trying to figure out what people would have been diagnosed with if they were living in the modern day. And sort of bringing up the hint that there might be something a little wrong with Jeb, which I at least picked up on and thought was a very interesting place to take the comic, that you have the sequence where Jeb rides through camp as they're trying to get out of town to go and deliver the message to the senators and the governor, and he's just creating chaos and setting the camp on fire, yelling and screaming and bringing all this attention, and he gets a man killed. And none of those consequences seem to register with him, that when they get away, he's just grinning and excited. On the one hand, it could come off as, oh, he's just young and stupid and he's not paying attention to consequences. But
Nate delivers him a consequence.
Oh, yeah. He gets a consequence. A knuckle sandwich of consequence.
Is that what we're going to refer to it from now on? Whenever somebody hits somebody, it's a consequence?
We should do that.
Superman and Doomsday exchanged consequences.
But I just thought that that was an interesting thing for them to not really address at any other points, but just to drop the mention of, I wonder how many other people back in the day, how many heroes and villains of the Old West had this disorder. Now, I've also been listening to the Arkham Sessions podcast, which is all about awesome. The psychoanalysis of Batman and the Batman supporting characters and villains.
Yeah, I was going to say, we don't want to get too far into that territory because they do it way better.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. They do it with, like, a person who has degrees and stuff, not me. I just thought that that was an interesting place to take it from a sociological point of view. I can't speak for the psychological representation, but at least for me, from this point on, I read Jeb as a person who had some sort of personality problem. Borderline personality, some form of disassociation, that from this point on, everything was colored with that lens. And I thought that if you didn't pick up on that, he was a well-written character. If you did pick up on that, then he's an insanely well-written character in that they wrote a character that had these hints of maybe being slightly unhinged without him becoming, you know, a Batman villain, without him becoming a caricature of some kind of mental illness. He's not responsible for any of his actions because he's crazy. But it just, I feel like it informed some of the actions, that there are just points where he does not act rationally at all.
It's interesting you bring that up because I kind of keyed in on that too. And that's very popular in just about all fiction, that we want to apply what we know in the present to what's going on in the past. And just the evolution of mental health. Back then, they, you know, you're right, they wouldn't have thought of him like that. But then I got to wonder, 20 years from now, is some other disorder or some other breakthrough in how the mind works going to totally do away with everything we know today? And how is that going to affect looking back at story?
That's the danger of assuming that
just
because we know more than they did then, to assume that we know everything now.
Right.
I'm not suggesting that Emily's wrong, because I think she's right. He's very, there is a lot of sociopath in Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Just in you said disassociation and thanks to the Arkham show that you mentioned, I'm now learning these terms a lot more. And it actually learning a lot about just how the mind works in general,
right.
Which I've always been kind of fascinated with, but never really looked too deeply into. The great thing is, though, is you look at Jeb here and then see Jeb in the last story arc of this series, and who he is then and what he has to deal with. It's a really nice mirror technique.
Mm-hmm.
That right. Ostrander sets up here and pays off later in the series.
Let's take another break here. We will come back and talk about issues 3 and 4.
Why do you think superheroes are so important?
People need heroes because they need somebody to inspire them, something to aim for, somebody to try to be like.
One is the man of tomorrow, with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. The other, the Caped Crusader, carrying out a solemn vow to spend his life warring on all criminals. For 7 decades, they've been the world's finest heroes. They've teamed on radio, comics, newspapers, animation, and more. And now, they're teaming up for a podcast.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Up, up, and away!
Atomic batteries. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Superman and Batman celebrates more than 70 years of the world's finest team with randomly chosen stories featuring the Man of Steel and the Dark Knight. Superman and Batman, featuring your two favorite heroes in one podcast together. Find it today at greatkrypton.com.
And we're back with Emily.
In issue 3, while Nathaniel Kent is on his way back from DC, Jeb's true colors begin to show. His face hidden, he actually encourages and then assists in burning down the Kent printing and publishing business. That'll teach you, Nathaniel. Shouldn't have run off to have all the fun without me, big brother. Nate is crushed when he returns home and sees the damage for himself, and is even more concerned when he learned that Jeb has been courting Lily Beaumont, the daughter of a local pro-slavery family. One night when the couple is hanging out under the stars, John Brown rolls up to the farm and slaughters the rest of the Beaumont family. Since he is from an abolitionist family, Lily sends Jeb away, blaming him for the deaths. Nathaniel and Jeb actually have a pretty nuanced discussion about the ethics of Brown's tactics and each man's personal investment in the issue. Meanwhile, Nathaniel meets Bill Hickok's gorgeous half-Delaware Indian girlfriend, Mary Glenowen. As the year passes, Jeb falls firmly under the sway of the pro-slavery forces, mostly by association with his new buddy, Charlie Hart. For a few bucks, he agrees to have some fun at the expense of some abolitionists. But events turn ugly and violent very quickly. As bad as things have gotten for the country and for Kansas and for the Kents, we're promised in a note from Pa Kent to Clark that he sent along with the latest package of documents that it gets worse. Much worse.
Now we're back to the action.
Mm-hmm.
This was an intense issue.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
There is so much going on here. Now, Mike, you said you had both the individual issues.
Yes.
And the trade?
Yes, I do.
Do you have them both accessible?
I have them both in my hand.
We have the individual issues, and there is a misstatement. On the very first page, it references President Buchanan, and he was not elected just yet. He gets elected later in the year.
It is different in the trade.
It should say Pierce, correct?
Yes, it is. That is one of the changes from the trade, and boy, is that an obvious piece of relettering.
Oh, it looks that bad, huh?
No, it's not that it looks bad. It's just...
It's an awkward place, and the words are not near the same length.
I've done enough seeing people do bad Photoshop
that
you can kind of tell that it wasn't part of the original, but it looks similar enough that it's okay. One of the kind of disappointing things about the trade is that the paper that the individual issues were printed on, this is a time period where they were using kind of a slick paper stock.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I would go so far as to call it like semi-gloss.
Right.
The trade is more of a matte finish. Some of the art, I mean, the art still looks amazing, but the massacre that happens with the different coloring and all that looks so much better in the individual issues than it does in the trade. That I'm really glad that I decided to just dig in and read the individual issues.
Right.
You know, when I was reading the story and just have the trade handy in case we wanted to talk about it.
And 15 years later, the individual issues still look, you know, good. They haven't faded. You know, that's one of the advantages of that type of paper and printing process. So I was glad to be back in Kansas after the trip to Washington. And there is really an interesting debate here between Jeb and Nate. Again, one of the more nuanced aspects, like you were talking about, wanting to see Mike. And I think in these two characters, we certainly see Jeb's struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we know that he comes out on the wrong side of morality and the wrong side of history. But you can see some of the steps in how he's getting there.
It's something that I appreciate and I think is really important whenever you're tackling an issue of any variety and whichever stance you're taking, is that you do represent your opposition well. That it just makes for a better story when you can avoid straw men. I think they do a good job of avoiding straw men, and when they have straw men, they have one for each side. That on the one hand you have Luther Reed, but on the other hand you have John Brown. Both just violent, horrendous, terrible people who
are using their personal religious and political convictions to further their own dark needs.
Exactly.
To be violent.
Exactly.
You know, the slaughter that takes place towards the beginning of this issue, one, looks like a zombie film at one point.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, really? I almost thought it was a dream sequence at first. Like, is this really happening? But I guess that really kind of served to give that a little more of a stark reality to it. This is what it looks like to them because they can't believe what they're seeing, just as I can't believe. But these are supposed to be the good guys, the anti-slavery people who are just slaughtering everybody they see
for no good reason.
Why. It's like one of those things. It's like, you know, I really don't agree with slavery, but you know, if somebody came and killed my family, I'd be pretty pissed.
I think one of the distinctions we see between the brothers is that Nate is looking, you might say, big picture. You know, his focus is on the issue, and I think Jeb's focus is on the personal. And those are both, in a sense, legitimate ways of dealing with this. Like, you know, as you're getting at, Mike, those are both reasonable and understandable positions.
One, again, we see a character that's gonna pay off later that we don't realize is gonna pay off later in that thing. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, the whole thing with the massacre, it's just, this is one of those moments where I was truly disturbed reading the story. You know, you said that it's not, you know, we're kind of joking that it's not dark. Yeah, this is pretty dark. In a lot of ways. But this issue, more than any other, made me feel for Jeb. And it was at this issue that I decided that while I disagree with just about every decision Jeb makes from here on out, I'm not going to give up on him. He's doing what he's doing because it's where his life is taking him. And while I completely disagree with it by the same token, I'm not living back then. I'm not in 1800s Kansas, and I'm not seeing my family fall apart, and I'm not feeling like, you know, I'm being abandoned and I need something and I'm lost. This is how hate groups get members.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day.
Right, by offering sanctuary, offering family, offering community.
Yeah, it's just, you know, someone telling him. And there's a little bit of rebellion in there, too. Like, he's doing this to stick it to his dad and stick it to his brother because they should have never come out here in the first place.
Right.
We shouldn't be doing any of this. you don't know any black people. I mean, seriously.
That is my favorite line in this issue.
That is a great point.
That is my absolute favorite thing.
You can see that, again, I won't get specific, but you can make that point about political issues today.
Oh, yeah,
people
absolutely.
Defending other people, quote-unquote, that they have no association with, don't understand, don't know. If they did know people like in that those groups or in those circumstances, there's some in political or social issues, it's easy to love humanity and not like people. I'm doing this to help society, but I don't like anybody.
Yeah.
You know, to not have to
I
have that
retail.
Sort of
I can relate to that.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but you know to have that sort of disconnect.
Yeah. And I will gladly make that point bluntly. I did not know any black people before I went to college. I now know like one. These are these issues that I say. I'm a sociologist, and yet I have these thoughts occasionally. I go, I want to stand up against instances of racism, but almost all of my friends are white. I don't actually know any of the people that are affected by this legislation. Or similarly, I know people who are like, yeah, all about gay rights and marriage equality and workplace protection and yada, yada, yada. They don't know any gay people. They've never met a trans person. They don't know. It needs to be coming not just from a headspace. That if you're going to be fighting for something like this, it does have to come from a place of genuine conviction. Which, spoilers for the next issue, Nate then goes out and does. And proves himself not a hypocrite. And I'm just, yes! You set it up. Set up a challenge. He meets the challenge. Well done. Scene
Absolutely.
Sequel.
It's kind of amazing. I grew up mostly in Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, the Civil War, and I'm pretty sure it's probably similar in Ohio. Civil War is taught much like World War II. These were the good guys. These were the bad guys. We won. Let's all go to Gettysburg.
Let me stop you for a second. We lived for 15 years in Virginia. It's a very different view.
Moving down here to Georgia, you know, it's just like, it was about states' rights. And oh, by the way, some of us still want to fight it. So it's such a weird difference. And I think that made reading this, if I was still living in PA and I had read this, you know, and still lived up there, I would have had a very different view of this being down here and seeing the more human side of all aspects of it.
Right. One of the notes I had on the earlier issue, actually, that I didn't mention was, we're given the fact that the Kent family is from Massachusetts. And, you know, I appreciate, obviously, Boston being a historically important city of the time, and I can understand that, but there was something about me that rubbed me just a little bit the wrong way of the elite Northeasterner was going to go to move to the Midwest to teach the savages, you know, how to be more civilized people. You know, I sort of wished maybe the Kents had been from the South or from the Midwest. You know, there was almost a patronizing attitude that I almost got until we get to know how sincere Silas and Nate are.
And I would say Silas more so than Nate, because I think what it does, you know, basically in that first issue is it gives us our perfect protagonist of our man who is educated, but is aware of the state of the world, is well-traveled, has met a lot of people, has lots of life experience to build on, who has convictions that are strongly held, but in moderation and with understanding towards other people. And then he's killed off.
Right.
And both of the sons, in a sense, lose their moral compass and are then sort of floundering and trying to figure out, well, I like these people, but I disagree with them. How can that be a thing? And in Nate's case, he distances himself from those people. And in Jeb's case, he sticks with the people and lets any sense of conviction that he might have had about maybe slavery is wrong, he's willing to let that get swept away for the relationship. Mm-hmm. And both of them are kind of wrong.
Well, the great thing about the end of this issue is, once again, Jeb is not a villain. He is an antagonist.
Right.
But he is not a bad guy. And you see that moment where you are given a choice in the position he is. You can either go along with this and ride with these people, or you can just walk away. And because he's really got nothing else going on, he chooses to go with it. And it was great to see that moment happen where you're like, oh, man. And still, but still not wanting to give up on him as a character.
Yeah, I love that point that you made before. You know, we are rooting for him. You know, we're rooting for him to make the right call at this point. There's still a chance.
Yeah. And I will just say this from this point on is my most common note that I made throughout this entire series was, ugh, Jeb. But it was like, ah, Jeb, come on. You could be better than this. And
you could be great again, Jeb.
You just get your life together, man. Just like I felt.
Sort your life out, mate.
Every time there was a sequence with Jeb up to this point and from the rest of the series, I felt like Nate. It totally put me in Nate's shoes that I'm like, I just want to grab this kid and shake him by his collar until something, like, the neurons knock together and he comes to his senses. But then we see that doesn't work with Jeb. He needs that strong brother figure that he's not really getting from Nate because Nate's trying to be their dad. He's trying to be more tough love, and it's just pushing Jeb further away, and you're just like, oh, just why? But it makes for great drama.
Issue 4. Nate Kent rides to the neighboring farm of a black man, Tobias Freeman. He introduces himself and asks Tobias to teach him a bit about farming. In exchange, Nate teaches the Freeman child, Joshua, to read. Jeb and Nate get into a fight over Mary Glenowan. Jeb makes comments that are, I think wildly inappropriate would be the right phrase. Nate slugs him. Again.
Gives him a good consequence.
And this time, guns are drawn on both sides. Jeb continues hanging around with Charlie Hart, or Bill Quantrill, as he's actually called, and his gang, which includes Luther Reed. They've taken to rounding up and killing abolitionists. And even though Jeb never pulls the trigger, he does stand by and watch. Even though he knows what they're doing is wrong, he sticks with Quantrill, who he views as more of a brother to him than Nate ever was. Meanwhile, Nate has heard that Hickok plans to leave town and confronts him about Mary. Bill says that he saw sense and broke it off with her, and Nate rides right away to see Mary. The two of them have a heartfelt conversation about identity and acceptance, but when Nate admits his feelings for Mary, she tells him her heart is too full right now. He understands, and the two separate as friends, for now. But he'll be back one day, holding a boombox over his head.
Playing in your eyes.
Play. Wait a minute. Bill Quantrill.
A harpsichord, so it sounds really weird.
A hurdy-gurdy. Continue.
Bill Quantrill and a couple friends show up at the Freeman place and try to take Tobias and his family to be sold as slaves once more. Nate arrives, pointing his gun at Bill, and says he'll turn Bill into the authorities. Jeb, on horseback, points his gun at Nate and tells him to walk away. Nate doesn't, and Jeb shoots his brother in the shoulder, then leaves him to bleed out. Jeb and Bill torch the Freeman's cabin to the ground. Nate awakens in a bed, being cared for by Mary Glenowan. She tells him Tobias and Sarah were dragged off, but their son Joshua escaped, and told Mary everything. Nate sleeps, having been given an Iroquois healing blanket with a suspiciously familiar red and yellow S pattern on it. Months later, when he's fully healed, he rides off, set on finding and freeing Tobias and Sarah. In her diary, Mary writes, "We are broken as a people, and we're all in need of healing. Most of all, what we now need is heroes."
And that's when Nate puts on the blanket as a cape and rides off into the woods.
As it flies away. Oh, if only.
If only he'd put it around his neck.
His neck, and ride off into the distance as it blows behind him with his luscious mane of not mullet flowing in the breeze.
I mean, we're jumping to the end, but the top of page 23. That's Superman in that bed.
Yes.
There is no doubt.
It's a great panel, but that was an almost jump the shark moment, sort of like we had a Lane and a Luther and a Kent all in the same issue. And we're like, okay, you're getting close there, Ostrander. Watch it. And this is the same one. I was like, but it worked.
This elicited a number of reactions from me. Because I remember this moment from when I first read it. And back in 1997, I was like, oh, man. Just because I thought, that's a little too cute.
Right.
And so when I got to it this time, I thought, okay, I'm going to have that same reaction. That's a little too cute. Oddly enough, like a bunch of other things popped into my head. Like, wow, you know, Ostrander was kind of ahead of his time because those Smallville people would mine the Indians and Superman and the caves and everything that happened on that series. Also, Jonathan Kent finds the blanket now. I really wish there would have been a line of dialogue that he always had the blanket because Jonathan Kent's the one in this continuity that came up with the S symbol.
Right.
Wasn't a symbol of hope. It wasn't, you know, a Kryptonian
crest. Symbol for whatever. Yeah.
It was just, hey, we want to make Clark look like the Mystery Men from when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been interesting to see, like, oh, I must have seen this when I, you know, Clark seeing the blanket. I realized I had seen it before. It must have been, but maybe he didn't want to be on the nose, or maybe he just didn't know.
I think that would have been that step too far for me. That. With the coincidence, I could accept, because this whole story is built on coincidences. I could let that slide. But if they'd said, and yes, Clark, it actually turns out that this is what I was thinking of, I would have been like, okay, whatever, Ostrander.
Now, Mike, there are lots of sort of different versions, as you mentioned, of the S symbol's origin. Do you have a favorite, or is there one that you prefer, or just...
I actually liked what Wade did, that it's not so much the crest for the L family, but that it's a symbol for Krypton in general, meaning hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the idea of Clark seeing that in the iPad that was sent with him, as he kind of has in Birthright. Jeffrey, one of the first disagreements Jeffrey Taylor and I had on From Crisis to Crisis, which is not meant as a plug, just meant as a story, that turned into a plug, so yay me. One of the first disagreements
we're dealing with a pro here, Em. Man, this guy is good.
It can be both. Totally acceptable.
One of the first disagreements we had was in the very first episode where Jeffrey was saying he really didn't like that Jonathan Kent just made up the symbol. And I kind of agree with him, but at the same time, for that version of Superman, I was totally on board with it. Seeing it here, and especially in the... I'm glad that, you know, Mary had the... time to make the lifelike wax double of Nate. Because that doesn't look... I mean, he doesn't look alive. He doesn't look dead. He looks like a dummy in that at the top of that page 23. And that's snarky, and I apologize. But still, this was the moment where I was just like, okay, it's been really cool seeing the S symbol on the covers. Because it always just kind of reminds you that this is something to do with Superman.
Right.
So on as a marketing gimmick, hey, buy it, because it has something to do with Superman. Having this symbol made me think, you think there's people who like study Native American culture that when Superman came out go, why does he have an ear symbol? So all of that swarmed in my head before I go, I gotta move on or I'm gonna get lost in thinking about this blanket.
Now here again we come back to Jeb. And we have a lot less subtlety here in the sides that he's taken. I guess place he's at here is that he doesn't mind getting rid of the black slaves, but killing white abolitionists is a step too far for him. And you can see where he's coming from, but that is a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Have either of you ever seen the movie American History X with...
No.
It's been on my list, but I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, one of the things that struck me about that film is that Edward Norton does such a good job playing somebody who is inciting people to racism that when you hear what he says, I didn't agree with it, obviously, because that's just not who I am, but I saw how somebody who's kind of disillusioned. Yeah, it's just like, you know, we think of Hitler as evil, but something about the way that man spoke to the people of Germany at that time, that enough of them were backed him that he was able to do what he did.
Right.
You know, the people who do that are able to kind of tap into something, into somebody's psyche. And with Jeb, he added 2 + 2, got 5, but he didn't care because he hates Common Core. So it doesn't really matter anyway. So it just made sense to him. Like, well, you know, I really don't like that, but I can't abide this. And his course is set. So yeah. When he does what he does, which is literally one of those holy crap moments,
yeah.
You know, where you almost want this to be like a long mini series on TNT or something.
Yeah.
You want to see this filmed because that moment at the end of the second part of the mini series,
every millisecond of
that. Yeah, I would be like, holy crud! I mean, he just shot his own brother. And it does two things. One, it puts Jeb firmly on his path.
Right.
And two, it's a really subtle hint at what the country's about to do.
Right.
So I liked it on that level, too. This was the issue where this series became something, went from something that I was enjoying to something that I absolutely loved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That I was all in at this point. I was just like, you know, man, I got to go to bed, but... Okay, I'm going to stop here because it's a good stopping point. But tomorrow I'm digging into the next issue.
Right.
Obviously, you have the racial components of the Civil War, the black and white Americans, but you've got some really interesting things going on with Mary Glenowen as well. And I thought her discussion about her race and identity was interesting, and certainly Emily, that's right in her wheelhouse.
Yeah, surprising none, this is my favorite scene of the first four issues. This whole discussion of being not white, but not native, not Delaware, just, I thought was brilliantly handled. It speaks to a concept that I mentioned to my dad, and he was like, okay, well, you're going to have to talk about that and explain it. But the concept of passing, which is an interesting psychological idea, but the idea of trying to make yourself as like the majority as possible in order to try and pass as that majority, be it racially or a gender, sexual identity sort of thing of staying in the closet. It's that sort of concept of just trying to distance yourself from some part of yourself that society views as negative. And it gives this really unfortunate catch-22 that Mary has found herself in, that she thinks of herself as white, and she has the great line about, I was brought up to think white, to act white, to dress white, and to be white. To what purpose? I was only fooling myself. Because as white as she can become in her actions and her dress and her thought, everyone is only going to see the Native American part of her. And unfortunately, when she attempts to go the other direction and assimilate into her mother's people, she doesn't feel at home there either because she doesn't know the culture. She doesn't barely know the language. She does not belong there either. So this whole discussion and sort of wrestling with identity and her place in the world that Mary was going through, this was the point where I was like, okay, so Nate's the main character, and Mary is my favorite character. Let's go. Let's see where the rest of this series takes us.
I always am drawn to characters like this in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my own personal life, I have always kind of more identified with people who are kind of outsiders anyways.
Right.
It's not that I had a bad childhood or anything. You know, I love my family. I had a pretty good childhood up until, you know, my senior year of high school. So it's kind of weird that somebody who grew up in the suburbs and had your kind of like quintessential late 80s, early 90s existence where everything was fine, that I would feel more for people who are in Mary's position that don't feel like they fit in anywhere. Because even though I had a pretty good upbringing, I kind of feel like I don't fit in anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm 38 years old and I still don't feel like I fit in really anywhere. So it's just, I look at those people and, you know, we were talking before about how, you know, you don't even know a black person. It's that kind of thing. Like, I can't be that. I can't, you know, totally say, oh, I understand exactly what she feels. But I think of people like that and knowing that, you know, like you said, this goes on today, where people don't really feel like, You know, they you know, because of something about them. There's a part of me that has this really naive outlook, like, why does it matter?
Right. You know?
But no, we don't live in that world. So you kind of have to, you have to kind of deal with things as they are. So,
you know, I think there is a, use the phrase in a broader context, but I think many groups have a political correctness idea mm-hmm. to them. And that if you step out of line in certain areas, whether it's, you can be in this political party, but if you disagree on two or three things, then you're not really quite as...
You're not on the same page with the rest
of us. Yeah, you're not really on the same page as, again, whether that's, you know, theological within a, you know, a church or religious setting, or socially or politically within a setting, or within a family setting, political grouping, or, you know, whatever it is, there are some norms. And if you fall too far outside too many of those norms, you run the risk of no longer being considered part of that group anymore. And no one wants to be a betrayer or a heretic, whether that's, again, politically, socially.
Racially.
Racially, religiously, you know, to be the traitor.
Since we're already talking about race, we'll bring up another thing, that passing is a concept I'm very interested in sociologically. Likewise, my most loathed thing in fiction is tokenism. I hate it. And as we were reading this, Dad brought up a point. He's like, okay, well, we now have, at the end of this issue, we have a white guy, a half Native American woman, and a black guy. It's like, okay, we're hitting all of our tally marks. But it feels genuine.
It does.
It's one of those things that this right here, sort of before our actual episode really started, I was talking about leverage. But leverage is my benchmark for how to do diversity properly. And this is one of those stories that I would put as a benchmark for comics of like, oh, you want to do diversity? This is how you do it. Making the race, gender, whatever other characteristics that you're trying to go for, a genuine part of the character, something that influences their personality and their worldview, something that influences the way people think about them, but not their defining characteristic. Mary is defined by being very loving and understanding, but also having a little bit of steel in her. She's got a backbone. She's going to stand up for what she wants. She's not going to let people walk all over her. That's what defines her. Not the fact that she's a woman, not the fact that she's Native American. Again, these are one of those things of coming up to this and being like, oh, okay, well, it might just be sort of a, well, we've talked about racism and, you know, African Americans. Okay, well, now we've got to talk about racism and Native Americans. So we've got to come up with a character that we can talk about this with. But she's an actual, legitimate, fully formed character. And I was just like, it's kind of sad that that's a low bar. That was my bar, was I just want her to be a character. And then she was not just a character, but a good character. Like you said, issue 4 is where I was like, yep, totally on board with this story. I'm going to read the next 8 issues in one sitting.
We were talking before about characters having kind of shades of gray and good guys doing things that you're just like, really? Bill dumping Mary for the reasons he dumped Mary are one of those moments where I'm like, God, you're a real jackass. But at the same time, socially, he might have actually thought he didn't have another option.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, especially since Bill becomes such a major part of the good guys in later. But Nate, we need to have a talk. I know courting is different in the 1800s, and I know that it's not like now where you hit up somebody on Facebook and you ask them out and all that. There is a moment to ask a woman out 30 seconds after the love of her life has dumped her and made her feel like she's less than human. Probably not your best move, but on a dramatic level, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. And I do appreciate that Nate was a good bro. That was what he and Jeb fought about in the previous issue, is Jeb's just like, oh, you're going to get the cojones to go and ask her out? And he's like, shut up, dude. She's dating my best friend. I was like, oh, you're a good
dude,
bro.
Dude.
But then, dude, not cool.
There's a movie I love that some fans of the Western genre hate, but I absolutely loved it, called Silverado, that has everybody that was acting in the 80s all in the same film.
Excellent.
I mean, Scott Glenn, Kevin Costner, Kevin Kline, John Cleese, Danny Glover, Brian Dennehy.
I need this.
Just like, and there's a moment where somebody dies, a man dies, and his wife is very attractive, and Kevin Kline's character, you know, is like, well, I'm going to go see if she's okay. And they all kind of snicker, and Kevin Costner goes, man, the body ain't even cold. And that was the thought I had here. It's like, wow, Nate, the body ain't even cold.
Yeah.
Bravo, sir.
You kind of got a golf clap. Like, I don't quite approve, but well done.
Yes, you need to see Silverado because it's
it fun. Sounds amazing.
It's written and directed by Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote Empire Strikes Back and Ooh. Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's him and his brother doing every Western they ever wanted to make in one film.
Okay, that sounds amazing to me. Because I like Westerns, as established by this, but I am not a Western purist.
There's a line early on in one of the letters columns that I think sort of sums up this first arc, these four issues. And Ostrander, I guess it is, or maybe the editor, is replying or writing almost the mission statement for the series. He says that Clark Kent is a good man, in large part because he's a link in a long line of Kents who cared about their fellow man and doing the right thing, and who passed along that type of character and conviction to succeeding generations. I think that's what we're getting at here in these first four issues in Nate, and we're seeing a little bit of it maybe going awry in Jeb. But I like that sense of continuity of what being a Kent means.
Right. And you mentioned earlier, Michael, that in at this time that Clark had been raised to think of himself as a Kent, as an earthling, as a member of this family from a very early age, and was not told about his actual biological heritage until he was a teenager. I am personally a fan of that. That I am a fan of Clark Kent as a character, and whenever the story falls into that trope of Clark Kent is a mask that Superman wears, I just, even if it's a good story, it just chafes against me a little bit. Because I like the idea that the reason Superman is Superman is because Clark Kent is a good man because of the way he was raised.
It's one of those interesting debates in Superman sure. fandom, which is a lot like a loud Irish family a lot of the time. We all kind of like each other, but man, we don't agree on a single thing, and we will scream at each other at the drop of the hat. I never saw people who all liked the same thing eat each other like I did last summer. when the movie came out, but
yeah,
growing up, you know, I liked Superman, you know, as a kid because of Christopher Reeve and the Super Friends. I started reading Superman because of the path that John Byrne kind of developed for him. And, you know, the debate used to be, well, who's the real guy? Is Clark the real guy or is Superman the real guy? And then somebody threw a monkey wrench in that idea for me by saying, well, neither one is the real guy. The real guy is the one that goes home to the Kents or goes home to Lois every night, and he puts on a front with both identities, which, you know, head blown.
Yeah.
I'm kind of weird as a Superman fan because I am the type that wants a certain level of, no pun intended, I want a grounding to the character. There are Superman fans that love the character because anything's possible and he can go to the Fortress of Solitude, and All-Star Superman is a perfect example of this. You know, yeah. He has a Fortress of Solitude that has a key made of white dwarf matter and the Titanic's there. And, you know, it's just like all these amazing things. And he's got a miniature sun eater that he keeps as a pet. That stuff is interesting. End of the day, bores me to tears. I want Superman to be the most interesting thing in the room. Outside of the villain. And that's why I think the version of Clark Kent, who was raised to think of himself as human, knows he has an alien heritage and embraces it to a certain extent, but at the end of the day wants to think of himself as a man, is a little more heroic to me, because he's making that decision that I am going to embrace that side of me. Plus, here's the thing I don't think a lot of people think about. I have known people who were adopted.
I was going to bring this up.
That were annoyed at the fact that Clark never really seemed interested in the Man of Steel reboot in his upbringing. Like, once he found out he was adopted. And I could see that. That would be kind of a burr in the saddle, so to speak. Because if you feel that way, why doesn't the most famous adopted, you know, child in popular culture feel that way? But I always took the side that you have a man that for 18 years believed something. It's hard to let that go. And think about that, 18 years, you know, you just of believing not only that you're not adopted, but that you're the natural flesh and blood of this, of these people, though really looking at Jonathan and looking at his family, you know, Nate notwithstanding, there were probably a lot of people going, did Martha have like a salesman blow through? What the hell's going on there? But at the same time, I just think it makes the character, you know, everyone's just like, Superman's the outsider. Superman wouldn't feel like he's one of us, but he still chooses to save us. So that's why he's a hero. That's great. It's not a character I want to follow, you know, for a long period of time, which Mike versus the new 52.
Yeah.
So it's just, this is why I love this series. So another reason why I love this series so much, because it's just rolling around like a dog in a trash heap of everything about this era of Superman that I loved. My one nitpick is, and I'm glad it's never overtly said, that the Kent farm that Jonathan and Martha live on is the same Kent farm that Nate had, because it's not. Because in the world of Smallville, it was revealed that the plot of land that the Kents live on, that Jonathan and Martha live on, was something that she inherited from her first husband, who had died. And it's all he left her was that parcel of land that Jonathan turned into a farm. And I like that story so much that I didn't want a retcon here. Well, the right. farm's been standing since the 1800s.
Right. If we're going to try and no prize this a little bit, it's not necessarily totally at any point stated that they buried the stuff on the plot of land. Maybe the heirlooms went to one of the sons who moved out and buried it in his yard. Then was Martha's father's... But they don't state it outright.
Well, I think that's going to wrap up our look at issues 1 through 4. Mike, where are we going to go to list discussions of issues 5 through 8?
A few days after Alan and Emily tell me they're going to post this one, I am going to post an episode over at www.viewsfromalongbox.com, where we are going to talk about the middle chapter, the most contentious chapter, I would say. The most historically driven chapter, I would also say, because of the Ken Burns documentary that kind of breaks out every once in a while. Come on over to www.viewsfromalongbox.com, where Alan and Emily will be nice enough to come over to my house. We're going to play in the Kent farmhouse a little more.
Thanks for joining us here on Short Box Showcase.
That was such a pleasure. This was awesome.
We've got to saddle up. We've got a road trip ahead of us.
I'm going to jump back in here at the end and thank Michael Bailey for guesting on this episode. For more of his thoughts on comics, his main site is fortressofbaileytude.com. From there, you can get his other efforts, including work at both the Superman homepage and Spider-Man Crawlspace websites. He hosts or co-hosts the following podcasts, and it's actually possible that I've missed a few. From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast. Radio KAL Live, Bailey's Batman Podcast, Tales of the Justice Society of America, and Comics Monthly Monday. Those last two are available through the Two True Freaks Network. So again, part two of this discussion will be available at Views from the Long Box about a week after this episode goes up. I believe it will be episode 185 of Views. Then part three will be right back here within a week from then, as the next episode, episode 19 of Short Box Showcase. If you have any questions about this episode, the podcast, or the Relatively Geeky Network, feel free to contact us. Our email is relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and specifically, if you came here from being a fan of Michael and a listener of Views, welcome to Relatively Geeky. We hope you'll stick around and check out more of the shows and episodes we have to offer.
Dearest Rachel, the episode is going on longer than we feared. I miss you so.
I promise I'll be home for Christmas.
But I have been looking forward to this like a lot.
Yeah, so. It's going to be fun. This whole thing was your idea, sort of. You loved short box and long box so much that we had to make it happen.
It's one of those low-hanging fruit things. It has to happen at some
really
point.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, there really is no... It's so obvious. I'm surprised, you know, we didn't do it sooner. But the funny thing is, the amount of shows that I've noticed in the last couple of years that have used long box in their title.
Right.
And I just have to assume that they have no idea that I exist. So, well, Stephen Lacey and I are going to... going to be teaming up in about a month or so to talk about Forever Evil, and I'm toying with suggesting
are you
gonna
do it in 20 minute increments.
No, it's just like not the 20. The episode's probably going to be called Not the 20 minute Long Box. So I am a little behind on y'all's shows, but I thoroughly enjoyed the Jimmy Olsen issue.
I was going to say good because I'm also behind on my show.
You were a lot harsher than I thought you were going to be, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Kids these days, Mike, no respect.
No respect.
No respect.
No, because I think I had the exact opposite, like the polar opposite reaction to reading that issue when I read it for the first time a couple months ago. So.
Oh, really? Oh, it was just more like, oh, nostalgic candy for my brain. This is ridiculous, wonderful, over-the-top Kirby wonderfulness, and I was just like, eh.
Yeah, and also there is my entire experience growing up reading Superman, the creators used all that stuff. Like,
right.
Every bit of what Kirby established came back during my era of Superman. I'm feeling like nostalgic for my era, but seeing where it's coming from, so I kind of feel like a paleontologist.
Yeah.
A little bit, where I'm digging back and seeing, you know, where the roots of all this are, so.
Yeah. I tried to convince her that the Newsboys of the 90s were not as annoying.
Well, that's the thing, is I heard the Newsboys got progressively better, but I was just like,
there is no justification ever for Flip a Dip.
None! That's an abomination!
I will totally agree with that.
Yeah,
that's one of my mantras. Yeah. Endings are hard.
This is why I've watched whatever it is, 68 episodes of 70 episodes of Leverage, and I've just been waiting for the right time to watch the last two because I'm like, if this sucks, like my fandom is over. I'm like,
I need to watch that show at some
point. You do.
I really liked the cast, like the idea that one of the guys is just the eternal ass kicker of the group.
Oh my god,
he's pretty great.
He is the best.
Both my daughter and my wife have crushes on him, so that's okay.
I need to start a Leverage podcast. It'll just be me screaming incoherently.
It'll just squee.
Be me trying to talk and then just failing.
Yeah, but if you play it backwards and slow it down, it's like this the most amazing critical analysis of the show you've ever
heard. Could be. So, you know, you're on Back to the Bins a couple of times, and you really wanted to start doing bits at the beginning of everything. It's the Spitaro effect, I call it. I'm still looking for a special thanks at the end of one episode of something. Episode of Walking Dead. I mean, there's some point. I'm sure you've pitched them the raiding the office supply store.
You can turn. The guy that picks up the stuff isn't really he's the gopher that gets everything for them. So
I mean, you can turn paper clips into weapons. I'm sure. I mean, there's plenty of stuff there. You've got paper cutters. You've got shredders.
Rip the arms off, and you've got machetes.
It's about the fact that the guy that played Flash Gordon apparently was a bad guy back in the 1800s. So that was a really lousy joke. I apologize for the quality of that humor. But I saw the name Sam Jones, and that was the first thing that popped into my mind.
That's a thing now. But it's...
I like being part of things. Go ahead. Before the break, I felt like we were all smoking pipes.
I know.
Indeed.
Yes. Welcome to the most pseudo intellectual podcast on the internet.
We emphasize the pseudo part. We do.
We almost sound like we know what we're talking about.
I know, right?
We ended up not using it, but you know, we have a Short Box Showcase promo now, and an early version of that. We were referring to the show as, was it semi-intellectual?
Semi-intellectual.
Semi-academic and pseudo-intellectual.
Yes.
Borderline pretentious.
Yep.
That's correct.
And that's really just, I think, internally just our mission statement. More than
yeah.
more than something publicly we want
to. Bad mission statement to have.
We try.